Instances Comics, Mike Dawson here, with a brief pre-show bit of business. In recent episodes, I've been trying to get my conversations with cartoonists to flow smoothly and naturally, and so I've been trying to do all the intro, welcome to the show, this is what the show is about, business, while on the air talking with my guests. So my plan for the conversation you're about to hear was for the two guests to introduce themselves, and we were going to talk a bit about their work before we moved on to the book discussion. But we got immediately sidetracked by something, and that never happened. So I never said who anybody was. So I'm going to do that now. On today's show, I am going to be joined by the cartoonists Dylan Harkes and Tom Hart. Dylan Harkes is a New Zealand cartoonist. He's very well known for his comic series Pickle, the book Hicksville, very well known for Hicksville, and his recent original graphic novel published by Fantagraphics, Sam Zabel and the Magic Pen. Tom Hart is a cartoonist and the executive director of the Sequential Artists Workshop School in Gainesville, Florida. He's well known for the Hutch Owen series of comics and books, as well as Daddy Lightning, which was published by Retrofit, and his memoir, Rosalie Lightning, will be published by St. Martin's Press in January 2016. We are discussing Silly Daddy by Joe Cipetta today, and I'm going to go to that conversation right now.
Hello, welcome to TCJ Talkies, the internet's only podcast hosted by me, Mike Dawson, who is talking right now. You can follow me on Twitter at Mike_Dawes. That's very hard for me to say. And that's it. Yes, this is the podcast, and like it on iTunes and write a review and all those things I never ask people to do. I'm very excited today. I've got two guests joining me. In what sounds like the TCJ Talkies evening porch. We're down in the south. We have a cup of lemonade. We're swinging on the porch with Tom Hart and Dylan Harkes. Welcome, guys.
Hi.
I'm Mike.
Hi, how are you? We're going to be discussing Joe Cipetta. Is it Cipetta? Is that right?
I guess it's Cipetta.
Cipetta?
Yeah, I don't know.
Have you guys ever met Joe? This is to go right into it, but have you guys ever met Joe Cipetta?
Sure. Yeah, I have.
Go ahead,
Dylan.
I met him once in 1998 at the Small Press Expo, and the funny thing is that event was later chronicled in one of his comics. And so I appear very briefly in that comic, but he turns all the cartoonists he met into kind of imaginary characters whose names end in Berry.
Yeah.
So he's Silly Berry, and Scott McCloud is Cloud Berry, and I turn up as Pickle Berry.
And you've met him too, Tom? You guys know each other?
Several times at many conventions. And if Joe had a table, that's where he'd be. You'd never not find him. Because he would be behind his table. Or maybe possibly pushing his box of books around, selling them to every single other table. But you'd never see him in the bathroom or something, or maybe getting some chips or something. He was always selling his comics.
You push his box of comics into the bathroom if you really had to go. Stick them in there. You never know.
I think if he thought somebody in the next urinal or something had an interest in some sort of ancillary thing that Silly Daddy hit upon in maybe one panel or something, he would know about it, and he'd comment. He would even cross streams to comment.
Okay. Really?
Get you to buy a Silly Daddy. Yeah.
You know, actually, if I was in this situation, I absolutely would buy whatever comic was put upon me just to make the interaction stop.
Is that like a phrase, crossing streams, Tom?
I've never heard of it prior to tonight.
Like what the Ghostbusters do. You cross the streams and you make a really powerful urine flow.
We've got off to a good start.
Well, so now all listeners know if they want to sell me their mini comic at a future convention, just approach me when I'm at the urinal.
And cross streams.
And then I'm definitely buying it. I guess the reason I asked that is because even though I've been around comics a long time, I think I just missed whatever time period Joe Chiappetta was like more active in the alternative comics world. While I've known about his comics, I've never actually met him or seen him at any conventions or anything. Because he doesn't seem to be going to these things anymore, right?
I don't get that impression. I mean, I get the impression that he does not, yeah.
Yeah. We skipped Sorry, go ahead, Dylan.
Well, Joe, I guess the really... the key period for Joe would have been from about kind of 92 or 3 through to about 98, 99. And he is still cartooning. He's still drawing, but he puts them online occasionally. And he's also self-publishing. He self-publishes digital e-books these days, but most of them aren't comics.
They're not comics. I didn't know that.
No, he's done a science fiction novel, and his most recent one I think is a book about biblical prophecy.
For some reason I assumed all those were comics. I know he did one about back pain or something as well. Is that a comic? You know?
Yeah, I haven't seen that one actually. I haven't seen all of them. I've got the science fiction novel, and that is just, it's a novel. You know.
Huh.
Prose. One of those strange books that are basically just words.
I don't understand. Not on this podcast.
It's this newfangled thing. All the kids are doing it.
Well, do you guys want to, because the reason you guys came on to talk about Silly Daddy was because I saw Tom talking about it online. Because I think maybe you've been rereading it recently.
Yeah, I had. I've been sort of devouring memoirs lately. Just trying to get my. I just finished my memoir, and I don't know. It's just a process of I'm just trying to process it. I'm going through other memoirs, lots of them, and so Silly Daddy was sort of on the shelf, and I remember loving it, but I never remembered how inventive and just consistently brilliant it was. Brilliant's the wrong word. It's sort of simplistic word, but it's so inventive. And I just didn't remember just how nonstop the invention was and how much heart and energy and all sorts of crazy thinking going into it. Just so energetic, that book. So anyway, yeah, I was really excited and just started tweeting about it or whatever.
Well, should we describe what the comic is?
Sure.
Good luck.
It is a little hard.
There's some owls. I just want to point that out. When the AC unit turns up, you might hear the owls a little better. The easy answer to what the book is about is it's chronicles him raising... his daughter, I guess the first appearance of his daughter, she's about 2 years old or something. It's called Silly Daddy because she called him a silly daddy at some point early in her life. And he clearly is one of these artists who just needs to create. And so when she came along, that became his main reason for creating, was to sort of document the story. But also at the same time, pretty early on in his marriage to her mother, they got divorced. So I can't really remember much of... it seems like the marital strife is pretty early on in the book, too. And I really hope Dylan will interrupt me or you too, Mike, if I'm ever wrong about any of these. But it seems like as early as Kochi, that's the daughter's nickname, as early as she's in it, the marital strife between he and Susie is in it.
Yeah.
And so that's the subject matter. But he approaches it from so many different angles and in so many different directions, and it's just all over the place in a good way.
Yeah, he very early on in the first issue, I think, he talks about his own crisis as a father when his daughter Maria was, just like 4 or 5 months old. And he was really struggling with the stress and pressure of being a father.
A young father.
Which clearly wasn't planned. You know?
Yeah.
And he describes how frustrated he would get, and he does a little story called I'm just trying to find the exact original title, because he sort of changed little bits of it in the final collection.
Yeah, because mostly what we were looking at, is this collection that was put out. I was a bad dad.
Yeah. The original title was I Was a Shitty Father.
Okay.
Oh, really? So he changed it?
Yeah. Well, it might be worth just, if we're talking about what Silly Daddy is as a phenomenon, it might be worth giving a little history of how it was published. So he started out, it was all self-published for a long time, although some of it came out under the Spit and a Half imprint, which is John Porcellino's imprint and Zine Distribution Network. And so Joe started self-publishing Silly Daddy, and I haven't seen the first few issues in their original form, but I assume they basically were mini comics.
I think they might have been comic sized pretty early on, but
yeah,
maybe I don't know.
I think they were. I mean, maybe even the first one was. I don't know, but the first seven issues, I only have in their collected form. So eventually, he collected the first seven as a little book called Silly Daddy, which came out from Spit and a Half, and that was called The Long Goodbye, was the subtitle. And that kind of really documents the whole process of his slow divorce from his first wife. So mm-hmm. it's the gradual collapse of that marriage. But at the same time, his embrace of parenthood and being a father. So, I was talking about that story, I Was a Shitty Father. And he describes in incredible detail the occasions on which he mistreated his daughter, culminating with slapping her. And then the immense shame he felt. And that was clearly a life-changing experience.
Yeah.
That he had to get off his chest by drawing it. And so that first appeared in the first issue of the mini-comic series, of the comic book series. And he eventually, he did 19 issues of Silly Daddy in comic book format. And, they had color covers, often really interesting, complicated color covers that would be two or three color used in very interesting ways. They often looked like they almost looked like monoprints or lithographs. I mean, a really sort of interesting use of color and texture. And also, different issues were different sizes. Some of them are bigger than others. Some of them are tiny. I mean, the issue 13 is. It's the same size as a kind of, a little mini comic. I don't know what you call that format in America, but the rest of the world calls it A5. Slightly different dimensions, but
yeah, we don't call it that. I don't know what we call it.
We don't know, you Americans. get with the rest of the world. Anyway, but some of them are really little sort of booklets. And then other ones are comic book size, and then some of them are even bigger than that, different dimensions again. And he did do 21 issues nominally that I know of. The last two, 20 and 21, were little photocopied booklets, so they look more like traditional mini comics. But there were three collections as well. So there was that first one from Spit and a Half called The Long Goodbye. The second one was published after he got a Zurich grant, and that's a collection of one of the stories, of the story from issues 9 to 11, I think, and that's called A Death in the Family, and it's a really weird sort of auto-bio science fiction story, so set in the future,
yeah.
But it's about him and his family and friends. And he kind of imagines these future lives for them all. It's very strange but extraordinary story. So there were those two collections. And then years later, in about 2004, I think.
Four, I think, right, yeah.
Yeah, so there was a very large collection published by Reed in their graphic novel list. And that's a collection that's kind of the definitive Silly Daddy collection. But it's not everything, and it doesn't include any of the colour, because there was always little bits of colour he'd kind of include. And he did go through and sort of slightly edit it as well, which we can talk about later maybe.
Yeah, because you mentioned he was, like, he had published something with John Porcellino, and John Porcellino is a character in a lot of these comics. But in the version I'm looking at, which is the 2004 one, he's changed John Porcellino's name. Which I
yes, that's
that
right.
He calls him Al in the family.
right. In fact, he goes through, in that story, he changes all the real people's names, except for his family. So Megan Kelso appears very briefly in that
story
as well. Yeah, she's talking by video phone to Julie Doucet, who was married to John Porcellino.
I thought that was Julie. I was wondering about that.
Yeah, so in the original version...
she says, what do I need a pencil for? I have money now.
That's right. Yeah, she's given up art to do kind of philanthropic works with her vast fortune. He sort of imagines this future, which, I mean, he drew this story in about 1994, and... So he sets it in the distant future, which is 2004.
Okay. Who can imagine
what
the world will be like?
And then it jumps another 10 years to 2014. So the entire story is now in our past. But he imagines that Julie Doucet has become so enormously popular and successful that she's worth millions, and her work is published in every language imaginable. And she's married to... John Porcellino, who's become this kind of iconic figure who is asked to introduce the World Poetry Championships. And, you know, he really kind of enjoys creating these sort of dream futures for them all. It's such a crazy, crazy story. But he changed all the names in the eventual collection. So you don't get quite that same buzz of oh my god!
Can we pause? Did he not change the names in the original version?
No. They're totally themselves.
That's funny.
Do you think that's just is Reed like was that a larger publisher?
Yeah. I mean, he self-published the first collection.
Was that like a pretty big publisher? Like, I know that he like for this collection.
Yeah, Reed's huge. Yeah.
So
they're like a real publisher.
So maybe would you think it was a litigious thing to not to not be slandering and libeling all these people? I'm just joking.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why he changed it. I'd like to know. I'm curious. Idly curious. I don't know.
I mean, I always like that sort of stuff when, like, you see the little nods to alternative comics. Like, oh, you know, I know that person, and, you know, I know what they're talking about. But I guess it doesn't really matter in terms of the storytelling.
Yeah. It's a feature of Silly Daddy, too, because his stories are all deeply embedded in his own life. And so... Because he spends a lot of time hanging out with comics people, there's a lot of comics people in Silly Daddy, and he sometimes does little jam strips too. You know, in the middle of a longer story, there'll be three panels drawn by someone else, and he'll play with other people's characters, lots of in jokes, a little bit like reading Cerebus, where you can just read the story. And some of it goes over your head.
Yeah.
But if you're immersed in the comics world, then you're getting layers and layers of other references.
When I was just speaking to Tom just before we started recording, and you were talking about, like, the amount of ideas sort of in the comics.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the amount of stuff to take in. Because this is something I sort of experienced, too, reading it. Like, it's a little bit overwhelming in a way. Like, it's really, like, jam-packed. Did you want to say anything about that, Tom?
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at the page. I went back to find the exact page where Julie Doucet, and it, you know, I'm frustrated that we're starting by name dropping and stuff, but just because.
Well, that's we're part of comics. We know.
Just because that page came up, I turned to that in the collection, and I don't have my original issues. I probably have them located somewhere, but I'm mostly working on the Reed collection. And the page, it's the second time Julie, who's called Judy here, and I don't know if she has a last name, she appears for you guys with the collection is page 148. But that page alone, the bulk of it is, yes, this Megan Kelso character video phoning into Julie saying, come into Johannesburg. It's a comic relief kind of thing. Julie is saying, they're going to fly me out there for another book signing. It should raise enough money to help the areas that need it the most want to come with me. But what's going on earlier in the page, and actually visually takes up the bulk of the page, is these strange rat dreams that John Porcellino is having, and they're feeding from the upper left part of the page into his mouth over this sort of dark crevasse into his mouth as there's this cat sleeping on his bare chest. And then he wakes up and there's these, and every angle is different and really compelling and interesting. And as Julie or Judy puts her weight on his chest, it's from this low angle and you really see her pressing down. Yeah. Think of it, jungles, savannas, the animals, the people, the inspiration. It was meant to be the South African kind cat issue. And then just suddenly you just see this imaginary issue of King Cat or Kind Cat, as it's called now, Drought by Al Indefamily.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the original and it's King Cat and John Puzzle.
Oh, that's so fun. And then, yeah. And then the next page is one single completely just pulled out from an imaginary issue as if it was drawn by John. Really compelling 9-panel comic, and then it just right after that kicks back to Julie, and then it kicks back to Maria. Now on page 151, Maria and Joe are having are on the bus, and Maria is having this intense dream that filters in on this like 2-dimensional plane into her brain as Joe is trying to wake her up. I don't know. There's just so much compelling stuff going on.
You know what I like about that panel? Because you see the one of the dream going into her brain, uh-huh. And then so Joe is saying to his daughter, "This is imagined in the future." His daughter's older, and he says, "Maria, wake up! We got to wash up at this stop." And she says, "Okay," but in her word balloon, you still see the design of the dream she's having, like sort of filtering over, like the word she's saying, sort of showing how she's kind of still half in that.
Yeah, and two panels prior to that was utterly mundane, and he's sniffing his own armpit, saying, "Man." Thing.
Well, I definitely had that experience though, because like, you know, to do these podcasts, like I like to like read the book and like write down notes and stuff like that, and like it's like every page is like something to comment on. It's like I felt like sort of like overwhelmed. I think I said that before. But like in a way, but so amazing about it, like I really did feel like it all pulls together in a way. Like things fold back in on like things that come up like fold back in on themselves.
I was just gonna say the ending of Death in the Family is really profound, and I find Death in the Family a great book. And I have no idea how he structured it. I have no idea if this ending was planned. It had to be because it's the title is sort of is intertwined with that. I have no idea if this sort of like antagonistic character, creepy guy who appears for a few pages. He just sort of appears once for a panel, and then a few pages later, he's picked up on, and then all these ins and outs with the Porcellino painting history and his art teacher, mm-hmm. and all of these other threads are being pulled together, and this disappearance and this reunion with he and his wife. He thought his wife was blown away in some sort of apocalypse or something. I don't know. All these things. I just wonder how much he had plotted out ahead of time. And the whole thing is just constantly moving forward. It's like this road movie, but it's more like they have to get where they're going. In the first part, it's we have to get to this, I think, comic convention in Boulder or something like that, or in Denver. And then in the second half, it's this poetry convention.
The structure of it is kind of crazy. I mean, it just rampages all over the place structurally. And there are digressions that don't kind of go anywhere, but they're awesome, you know. And then there's other digressions that end up reappearing later on, and they're significant. And to me, it feels like he was kind of winging it, but in such an incredibly interesting, creative way, it all completely works. And when you read Death, see, I just over the last week, I just reread everything I had, all the back issues, and then compared them with the collections and so on. And Death in the Family, when he serialized it, there's little bits that are missing, but which he's taken from later issues, because he collected it quite a while after. He'd done about another 7 or 8 issues by the time he got the Xeric grant and did the collection. And he did one issue like a year after he finished serializing Death in the Family, which is called a Death in the Family interlude. And it totally is. It's just a little sequence that he later just slots into the middle of the book.
Oh, wow.
So the characters, he and Maria are, they're sort of on the run, and they pause in a field and eat. And while they're doing that, they're interrupted by these crazy superheroes. And that whole sequence was done like a year later. And he must have thought of it and kind of drawn it up, and then he added it to the book, where it's meant to go. And it kind of explains some of the stuff that is later slightly abruptly unexplained if you just read the original issues.
Can you give us page numbers for people who have the Reed collection?
Oh,
Also, that's not in the Reed collection, right? So you said that interlude.
No, it is.
It is there.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll find
the
that.
Stuff
feel
in
free to talk among yourselves.
Is it? It's not. Is it the stuff in pencil?
Well, yeah. It's in the middle of the scene in pencil. Suddenly.
Okay. So you're talking about 156 through 160.
Yeah, that sounds about
61.
Right.
Now, it continues. The pencil stuff continues. It's actually hard to tell where that might stop.
Oh, yeah, no, you're right. No, you see, it's not in the Reed collection. You're right. That little insert is not in the Reed collection.
Oh, it's not.
It's in the Xeric collection.
Oh, crying out loud. Really?
You see? It's a complicated publishing history. But there is one page. If you look at page 155.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a little flashback, and it's a flashback to when Maria is still a little girl.
Yeah,
and she's saying, "I would like to live in this house." She's playing with a doll's house and with dolls. She's saying, "I would like to live in this house," and Joe says, "What if spiders got in there?" And she says, looks at him and says, "You would kill them for me." Now, that sequence comes from a much later issue. And then he dropped it in when he did the collection.
Because that fits very well where it's dropped in, because right before that, in this story that's set in, I guess this is the 2004 future, he and his daughter are at a bus stop, and she's been, there's this weird guy.
This is a spoiler alert, isn't it?
Well, it's a book club, so we gotta talk
about this. Oh, okay, cool. Spoilers.
This all happened in the past and the future anyway, so...
Yes. But anyway, so he has just murdered a strange man who is basically appears like he was going to molest his daughter. He's throughout the book, he's always talking about how he's got this pocket knife, this trusty pocket knife, that he'll for protection, and he uses it to stab a stranger to death. And then the next page is the page you're describing, where she's a little girl again, and saying that he would kill the spiders for her.
Yeah,
you're
saying
that was actually from a later...
Oh, totally. That was from a much later issue in which he was just doing lots of little moments that he's shared with Maria, and that's one of them. It's a little two-panel strip that he calls Silly Daddy Exterminator.
Yeah.
But it's just in the context of a whole lot of little cartoons about his life with Maria in the prison. But it's a lovely thing to insert at that point, because it is a really interesting echo with the the story.
It's funny that, like, every time I look up, like, looked up a little something, like a description of Silly Daddy, whatever, and I think a lot of the times the descriptions have been written by Joe Cipetta. It talks about being like an autobio comic. It says, like, oh, this is like a very long-running autobio story. But it's not an autobio. It's never, almost never, like an autobio story, like when it's just telling a story of a thing that happened. Like, it is always like these imaginary, like, you know, tangents and, like, extended tangents. Like, I feel like maybe that first couple issues were like more like a little bit like a regular autobio comic. Like, here's like a story, like a thing that happened. You know, like they go to an art opening, like it's just this, you know, or it's the thing about like, you know, there's a fire. He imagines there's a fire, you know, in their apartment, and he thinks about like how he should get his family out. And it's just a bit more like those are just like, was it vignettes kind of thing? But that seems to get dropped pretty quickly. It's just kind of amusing that, like, it's always described as an autobio comic, and it doesn't ever feel like a strict autobio. Like, it seems like the autobiography is sort of a little bit more roundabout to arrive at.
It was straight autobio until about issue 7, I think. So, I mean, if you're looking at the Reed collection...
Until the end of the divorce, I assume.
Sorry?
Until the end of the divorce?
Yeah. It's the last section of the long goodbye, the kind of slow disintegration of the marriage, which was initially in issue 7. I feel like I'm talking like a catalogue here.
It's okay. Welcome to the TCG Talkies. We're just going to, we're like the back of the Comics Buyer's Guide.
It's partly just that I find the sort of constant repackaging of it and rewriting of it is one of the things that's interesting to me about it. But mostly he started out just telling the story of his family and his relationship and so on.
Yeah.
Really very straight. But right towards the end, so he divorces his first wife, and but then they do get back together again, and that lasts for a little while, and then they broke up permanently. And the last chapter of that part of his story, he describes going to a comics convention with his wife. And the first page is quite straight, you know, it's just them sitting at the comics convention. And then it slowly starts to drift into this strange kind of fantasy version where his old friend appears as a superhero. And there's another sequence where he and his wife are wearing these strange kind of superhero costumes. And then just all bets are off, you know. It gets really, really strange. And he has imaginary sequences in the future with John Porcellino and their old art teacher. But that sequence, it felt like a dramatic new direction for him. And then he pursued that for quite a while after that.
It should be pointed out that he always did whatever he damn well pleased. Issue 4 was entirely early 1990s computer art. Fake covers of Silly Daddy number 4 with, 1994 or 95 Photoshop.
Yeah, and there's, you know, one page is just, it's an ad for the Smoochipotamus Academy for using art supplies with pictures of his daughter, photographs of his daughter, just making an enormous mess on the table with using up all his art supplies. And it actually reads a little like a manifesto. He says, we'll bring you back to where it all began, when being an artist meant not how good you were, but how much art supplies you could use up in the process.
Yeah.
The good old days, you know, when a new refrigerator exhibit went up every day and no one dared to criticize your work. You could do no wrong.
Yeah.
And it's you know, that he's just playing. He's just constantly playing and having fun. And it feels, it's this weird mixture because it simultaneously feels really ambitious. You know, each issue was crafted as a as an object which he would then relentlessly try and sell at events and so on. And he was really trying to make a go of it. You know, this was his life. He was dedicating his life to making his art and getting it out there. But at the same time, when it came to actually, you know, what am I going to put in my comic, he acted as if he could do whatever he felt like. Complete self-indulgence, total whimsy, that was fine. You know, there was no compromise made to making it kind of commercial or marketable or even, you know, slick or professional looking. It's like picking up someone's incredibly inventive, crazy, entertaining sketchbook at times.
Yeah.
I should point out also that professionally, he didn't care much either. Leela is very fond of saying that when she worked briefly at Million Year Picnic in Cambridge, they got a package from Joe of Silly Daddy comics packaged in a cornflakes box. And cornflakes spilled out of it when they opened it. There was...
It was like a free bonus. I wanted to read this. This is something that's not in the Reed collection, but it's in issue 18 on the inside back cover, and it's called Manifesto Jojo, and it's really his artistic manifesto, and it says, "Do not die for your art, but live for it. Express not only that you are alive, but also that it is good to be alive. Express this even if you feel bad, and you will feel better. Be relentless in creating and exhibiting. The two go hand in hand. No one cares, so it is up to you to make them care. Never give up. Always work and create constantly. Save even the bad pieces, because one day a way to make them good will emerge." Mm. And here's my favorite bit right at the end. "This isn't the bomb squad, so take unnecessary chances."
Oh, that's great.
Isn't that good? And he finishes with, "Keep your hands fluent and flowing, keep your mind free and clear." But to me, that really does sum up his aesthetic, especially that line about, "This isn't the bomb squad, take unnecessary chances." Because every, not just every issue, but every panel, yeah, you know, he takes risks. And he pushes it in crazy directions, and you always feel like he's working right at the limit of what he's capable of doing. There's such incredibly alive drawings.
Yeah, and sequences and all sorts of things. And you get the impression he's... Like, I read, you know, you can read a lot of clever comics, you can read a lot of ambitious comics. And these are both of those things, but only because Joe was just trying to do something and make it as alive as possible. It was not about trying to impress anybody, I don't think.
Yeah.
Do you find... I have a question, Dylan. Because you... I don't know, Tom, did you also read... you said you read some of these as mini-comics.
Yeah, sure.
Do you think that maybe this type of work... This is just a thought that just came to my head. So it's not that well thought out, but I would say one sort of negative thing about the collection is that in a way it's sort of exhausting. I don't know if that's part of it because I'm reading it to, like, you know, do a podcast, but, like, it's so much and, like, it's going so many different directions. Do you think it maybe was, like, better enjoyed, sort of a serialized kind of thing where each thing was sort of his own little part? Do you have any thoughts about that? Like, about enjoying it? No, yeah,
thanks, Tom. I do have an answer, but Tom can start.
Oh, I don't. I really don't have much to say. I always love a little package. I always love a self-contained unit. But that's also the kind of reader I am, and another kind of reader can really love this Reed collection. Read 10 pages, put it down, and then pick it up again and get just as much out of it, I imagine. But
I think that's like probably one of the better ways to enjoy this.
I don't know. I imagine Joe would appreciate that. I've lost half of his issues, but when I find them, I reread them, and I really like them, and I read them out of order and stuff. But, I, you know, that's the peril of all the small little units, but it's also kind of seems natural.
I definitely think that the collection would be best read over quite an extended period of time, dipping into it. I mean, he made an effort in the collection to make it a slightly more coherent package. He sort of inserted little bits and reorganized things a little and dropped things so that it could form a kind of coherent narrative, but it doesn't work all that well, because it was such a pleasure to reread them all as individual issues over the last week, because each issue feels like a little art object, and they're printed on newsprint as well, which actually I love. And the thing about the newsprint is that the black, he often has very delicate thin black line work, lots and lots and lots of lines, especially when he's drawing people's long black hair. You know, it's just lots and lots of little pen lines. And on newsprint, the color of the paper is not, it's not like the opposite of the black line, if that makes any sense. It's like when you have that kind of line work printed on very crisp white paper, especially if it's gloss, which I can't stand, the white is shining through the black so strongly, it's almost hard to really lose yourself in the line work. But when it's printed on newsprint, you can kind of just ease yourself into it, and you're not staring at these stark contrasts. Mm-hmm. The line work and the, especially old newsprint, because these are getting on a bit now, these comics. I don't know, the lines are more kind of delicate and subtle. It works really well. But I feel like Joe's comics are absolutely, they're very much from the 1990s in terms of what was happening in comics back then. I mean, in a way, they're timeless because they're such extraordinary pieces of work. But in terms of the way the publishing models work now, you know, it's hard to imagine them coming out today, because today everyone's obsessed with doing graphic novels and trying to reach as wide an audience as possible for their graphic novel and getting written up in the New York Times. And that's just not where Joe's coming from, and his work doesn't function that way. You know, he was crafting these beautiful little 24-page, 32-page newsprint objects with color and delicate line work and strange interwoven stories and fantasies and I don't know that I don't know how much he was thinking about audience or anything, and it's like they're coming from a completely different world to most of the graphic novels that are coming out today, which are kind of the dominant form comics has now.
Yeah.
Excluding web comics, I guess.
Well, it's interesting, though, because he, as we mentioned much earlier on, like, he's actually an active web cartoonist in a way, in that he's making comics for the web, so therefore that's all it takes. But he doesn't seem to be a part of the conversation of, like, you know, people don't consider him. And I wonder if that's possibly because of, like, you know, at the end of this book, spoiler alert, is sort of when he finds religion. And gets very, and from what I know, gets very hardcore into it, and like all the work is very religious now. It's also all drawn on his phone, from what I could tell. Like it's all,
yeah.
I think it's so interesting. Like I was looking at his website, and he has like little comics, but not big ones, just like little small things, like little vignettes or just a little scene. And it'll be a picture, you know, like a kid says something funny or whatever. And then at the bottom it'll say, like, drawn on a Samsung 3, you know, phone, you know, edited in MS Paint. Like, so all just drawn by phone. Like, he's just, like, drawing it all on his tablet or whatever. I wonder if that's sort of...
Go ahead. The other incredibly idiosyncratic thing about those web cartoons he does is it'll be, you know, a picture of his daughter saying something funny. And then underneath there'll be this long paragraph which says, you know, a father is sitting with his daughter who
says something funny.
Says something funny, and then it quotes what she says and then explains the joke at great length. it's like I don't know, it's this strange thing he does, which I can't not read those bits either. Which
I wonder,
I wish I could just look at the cartoon.
I wonder if that is a cataloging, web cataloging kind of thing, where he's trying to get into search engines or something.
Keywords.
Yeah, because you're right, he's repeating exactly what's happening in the comic.
God knows. I don't know. The thing about Joe is that all his work is incredibly idiosyncratic, so I dare not really try and pin down why he's doing anything. He's just doing it.
I found it very inspiring. I was made me sort of feel like I wanted to shake off a little bit of that, like, feeling constrained and just make comics in every which way. Because I actually had read these, like, a couple years back, and I didn't like them that much the first time I read them. I think I was, I think that story you mentioned specifically about the convention where it veers off into, like, all the different directions, like, all the superhero stuff. I think I was like, oh, you know... You know, where's the straight autobio gone? You know, I just want that sort of straight thing. But now I sort of see that as, like, the moment, like, where it kind of, like, takes off and becomes something a bit better, like, a bit, you know, I don't know, it never stops. Sorry, I interrupted you, Tommy. You were going to say something.
Oh, was I? No, I don't remember. Just that the immediacy is what gets me. Like, it's such simple platitudes, but... He just needs to create this story. He just needs to sort of, like, weave, as he even says in his manifesto, it's like he needs to sort of, like, weave his art and his life together. And again, there's no concern, like Dylan was saying, for pre-existing packages or pre-existing formats or doing it the normal route. The New York Times graphic novel or whatever. It's just him really just, but again, I think, you know, one of the reasons I'm so compelled by Silly Daddy is I sort of want to sit Joe down and ask him. I'm sitting here saying it's so immediate and acting like it's just all brute force, but I actually, there's gotta be a lot of planning involved, and I really wonder how much and how much even the planning might've been a part of the thrill of it and seeing if he could pull it off, you know? See if he could get to the ending of Death in the Family and actually make it mean something.
As I read the collection, and as I said, like, you know, you try and do it in a short period of time, it's a lot to take in. It doesn't feel like there's an arc necessarily. But then I sort of realized, like, it does sort of pull together, and you realize the arc is having a lot to do with the fact that he lost custody of his child, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that he's basically, you know, dealing with that, you know, the pain of that. Like, that he's only seeing his daughter, you know, on weekends because of the divorce. And that this has been, like, a very sort of roundabout, like, examination of, like, you know, all his emotions and, you know, and his relationship with his family. I sort of felt like I realized that it was more of an arc there than I sort of was seeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right that it's about those issues. I don't want to say he kidnaps her, but in the beginning of Death in the Family, he basically just kind of sweeps her away from her mom to take her to this comic book convention in Colorado, leaving Illinois. So that's, I don't know, 1,000 miles or something.
Yeah.
But he also sort of superimposes, like Dylan was saying, it's a sci-fi story. He superimposes these hyper restrictions. Everybody's got to get a barcode. The parents, his old wife Susie and the new stepfather are all head up about getting these barcodes. You can't do anything without these barcodes. And he's going to, like, whisk her away and keep her away from all of these capitalistic, predatory sort of ideas. And yeah, I mean, that has to be, you're right. I mean, he's processing the loss of the custody, and it's just so much going on.
I will sort of, one sort of critical thing to say, like, just sort of the character, is that there's a lot of, I think I've seen it described as, like, the man being a life force and the women being, like, you know,
sure.
he I felt like he's throughout, like, continuously sort of talking about his sort of qualities as a, like, as a partner, but in a way that, you know, you sort of see him as, like, this person who lives by a code, and he's an artist, he doesn't care about things like clothes and, like, you know, keeping his hair nice. And his ex-wife, you know, she's no fun. She, you know, she can't, you know, she just, you know, she's never up for anything. She isn't up for adventure, and, you know, so there is. But that's, I mean, obviously, that's just something is like, it, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, I think, I mean, throughout it, he's wrestling with masculinity and machismo.
Yeah.
His dad is a Vietnam vet, a karate expert, a former PI, you know, he brings them up to be strong wrestlers. So Joe does all this wrestling in his youth, and he's surrounded by these friends who are kind of these dudes, you know. And this doesn't come through quite so strongly in the collection because he didn't collect some stories because once he'd become very involved in the church. He felt that, you know, he didn't want to keep certain stories in print that were full of swearing and sex and men being particularly bad.
Okay.
But he did a number of stories. He did one whole issue called Valets I Have Known, which is just this beautiful little kind of illustrated prose piece about his group of friends, his brother's friends and people he's met. They all work as valets. And he just tells all these stories about them, and they're just awful, absolutely awful stories. About predatory guys treating women really, really badly. And so that's clearly that's the cultural context that he's grown up in and been surrounded by, and which he kind of wrestles with. And he's trying to reinvent himself in various ways throughout the whole series until he finally reinvents himself as a born-again Christian.
Yeah, which is a bummer. I'm sorry. Bums me out.
It's funny, I just read, he sent me, some years ago, he sent me some of his Christian mini comics and booklets, and you know, there's still lovely drawings in them, and they're still full of drawings of him and his kids and his wife Denise and his world, you know, but there's this strange thing where most of the text is biblical quotations, so he'll just set a biblical quotation to a series of drawings of his family, but a lot of the intimacy is gone. It no longer feels like he's prepared to really expose his inner thoughts or what's going on for him. It feels. It feels much more like he's staying on message the whole time.
When I was looking at the website, I think the first post is up there now. I'm not sure if it's pinned or not, but it's sort of like a description of like what the Silly Daddy series is about, and it's talking about how it's about family units, and it's sort of reinforcing the idea of a family unit being made up of a husband and a wife and some children. And you're like, that's a bummer.
Well, I'm curious about. I don't look. He seems. I don't know. He seems very happy, and I don't. It's not.
Well, I never begrudge anybody any happiness, but that's.
It's
not
working for him, I guess.
John Porcellino would always say, "Joe never did anything halfway." You know.
Yeah.
You could have predicted if he was going to become Christian, he was going to be pretty darn intense about it.
Yeah, and he sent me something called Weapons Not of This World, which is like a little kind of 38-page autobiography in prose with a few drawings, but it's mostly just him telling his story, and it's kind of his conversion story. but it starts when he's five. But he actually says something in there about just before he was converted, and he was kind of feeling burnt out on what he calls his art faith. Mm-hmm. So he talks about using art as a kind of a substitute for belief in something bigger. But he was hollowed out on it by the time he found this other faith, which clearly he's now finding more satisfying. But he is still drawing. I mean, it's clearly making art is still important to him and still something he does. Yeah, I don't know.
That sort of art faith thing. I think there's even I can think of cartoonists like who are like that today, like sort of like married to comics kind of thing. That's probably a tough way to engage with comics. You know.
But I think it's tough in a way. It's tough not to. I think whether you're making comics or writing or doing music, the world kind of demands that you marry it, you know, it demands that you adopt it as a vocation and spend every waking moment obsessed to it. It's not treated as something that you just kind of do as your job. I don't know, does that make sense? Like, I feel like I really fought hard in my own life I had to fight hard when I had little kids to not let my art be a conflict with having a family, you know. And my art suffered in the process. You know, I had a lot less time to draw my comics. I would have been a lot more productive for about 15 years if I didn't have kids and didn't have a family. And I know a lot of cartoonists who have actually made a deliberate decision that they would not, that their art came first. And they've chosen not to have families and not have relationships and things, and they live a kind of monastic life. And they're really, really productive. And I sometimes feel really jealous of that.
Yeah.
Sure.
But I mean, you guys are the same. You know, we all know that it's not that easy to be an artist. And when I say, I mean, for that to be your career and your kind of vocation, but also to have a life.
What do you think, Tom?
You can always be poor, which is what I don't mean that too glibly. I don't know. My little one's only two. I think one reason I'm compelled by Silly Daddy again is Joe, I do think, was at least on the page from this distance, was balancing life and art pretty nicely. It seems like they were keeping each other healthy. The art was feeding the life was feeding the art. I think some people need that. I think Leela and I need that, you know, just to bring my own family unit in to it. Time and time again, I may not always choose to sit down and do a page, but I've always chosen to keep art making and comics specifically very, 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 very close, very, very active in my life. And I've managed to keep, I think, my family time and my family life pretty active and engaged and lively, but I'm desperately poor. so I mean, I think it's probably a three-legged stool that, in this case, only has two, right? And you choose your two. I don't know. That's just how it looks from my vantage point.
Yeah.
I don't even know if I'm answering the question.
I mean, I'm not sure what the question even is. I think it is something like I can most definitely relate to this sort of, you know, push and pull. Mm-hmm. Of, like, you know, the desire to put this thing front and center because it's the thing that you chose to be, like, important to you, like, and it's sort of, especially people, I guess, of You guys are, as we were talking, you're a little older than me, but like I think of our generation, we sort of like just put a lot of value in just making the work, and like the work is the thing, and you know, and just doing it for the love of doing it or for the passion of doing it. It's actually something I often in recent years I want to try to shake off a lot of that sort of outlook, because I want to try to be happier, you know, as an artist, just sort of like to try to think of it less in those terms, but. But then whenever I do, I start to, like, instantly, like, bristle at the thought of, you know, trying to, like, compromise the way I'm approaching making comics. Because then there's a big part of me that's always like, well, if I'm never going to do this for a living, I'm never going to ever get to do it full time. Like, I'm just going to do what I want to do. And that's, like, that's why, like, I find, like, reading this book, like, so sort of stimulating. Like, that sort of, like, just doing it the way you want to. Yeah, so I don't know if I'm answering the question either. We're off.
It's probably unanswerable.
I think it is unanswerable because the conversation never ends on Twitter. And it's always the, you know, about this sort of topic.
But it's interesting that Silly Daddy would provoke this kind of discussion. And I assume we're sort of nearing the end of this discussion. It feels like we've all left a sermon and now we're walking out sort of reflecting upon it. Like, what do you know... What do you think he meant by that? Are we able to live in Joe's, you know, in the way that Joe lived?
What would Joe do?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's like, I think I sort of was like speaking sort of critically when I was talking about how he presents himself all the time as a man with a code, kind of in a way, like, you know, an art, you know, he's got such passion for it.
Well, he clearly backtracked on it too.
What I was going to say is that I think that also speaks to a little bit of my own sort of self-consciousness of those sort of grand statements that I would never, like, but it, I obviously is the way I feel, you know, because I've not quit making comics, despite all encouragement by the economics of it to do so.
For what it's worth, and I don't know if this speaks directly to what you're saying, but Joe always goes out of his way in his comics to portray the secondary characters, meaning the people who aren't Joe, in their private time and how they think negatively about Joe. They're doing it all the time. Susan, yeah. Niece, everybody. They're in the car. They're thinking that stupid old Joe thinks this, this, and that. So he's clearly looking at all angles.
I love that he did that.
I feel like... Sorry.
I love that he did.
Yeah,
you go ahead. You go.
Go, Dylan. Interruption fine. I was just going to say, you know, clearly there's a lot of struggle in Silly Daddy. You know, Joe is constantly, he's a very intense guy. And he's always kind of analyzing himself and giving himself a hard time and trying to make sense of things.
Well, I guess actually, for the loss that he's sort of dealing with through this book, like, you know, which is basically of his marriage, and therefore, like, the time spent with his daughter, that all comes out of, like, his sort of, his life outlook, and his sort of, how he's placed things, because that's probably what led to, you know, him and his, things not working out with his wife, and, you know, because he doesn't, you know, it probably is related, like, that's sure. What sort of is the, you know, the cause.
Yeah, he says as much. I mean, in fact, in that Weapons Not of This World thing, he talks about how that was a big part of why that relationship broke up, is that he wasn't prepared to compromise. I'm interested too in the fact that both of you have done comics about being a father. As well, in fact, you know, father of girls as well. And I wondered how, you know, when you read Silly Daddy, whether you related to it in relation to your own comics about being a father.
I did, sure. Constantly, especially Death in the Family. I keep talking about it because it's basically a road movie. It's like you and the girl going out on the road, and And the Maria, his daughter's a little bit older in that comic, so they can actually have these lengthy conversations. And she's just, you know, she's just, if I remember right, 14 or 15 in that comic. Of course, it was drawn when she was 4 or 5, right? So they're, he's actually wrestling with a lot of ideas, which she's got her own opinions on. It's lovely. And yeah, it's the kind of thing I'm always thinking about, whether just in regard to my daughter or in regard to the comics that I feel like could be inspired by that relationship.
Mm. Yeah, I have that. I mean, I have that too. Like, I sort of felt like, but in terms of like doing comics about kids, like I've been doing that a lot lately, and I reading this, and then last episode I was talking about James Kochalka. I these were cartoonists who I didn't realize might have influenced me much more than I like might have understood, in terms of like yeah, like wouldn't have thought those people were like as influential to me, but then reading these comics I'm like, oh, this is kind of work I these little essays, these little musings about like parenting and like, but sort of like, you know, going off on like, you know, into these like different directions, like sort of trying to look at having children from all these different points of view, like or in different different contexts. Because I mean, there's a thing I took a picture of, so I'm probably gonna put it up on the blog post. There was a panel, I think it's in that scene where it might be when it's drawn in pencil during the death in the family. And he talks about like how once he had a daughter, you know, the way he's looking at the world is different, and everything's like feels political now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I very much like, yeah, I think I very much had that, you know, that I'm, you know, this thought about like how the world is for the kids, and, you know, now everything seems like a little, you know, it's not the same as it was.
Yeah, and let's note that. I really feel like having, and I see it echoed in Silly Daddy, and I actually feel validated, I think, and I sort of do look to this version of Joe as an inspiration. I think having a kid is a really an amazing experience, and it should make you more engaged with being alive, I think, and not less so because you're making less art or whatever. In the way that it made him more politicized and more active and less cloudy, I really value that, and I just believe it very firmly. I think he's a great role model, or his character in that instant is a great role model anyway.
Yeah. I also, he has lovely descriptions of what it's like having a kid. I mean, there's a bit in Death in the Family where he talks about, you know, he didn't ever imagine himself as someone who would have kids. It never occurred to him. And then when it happened, he says, a child adds a new dimension to everything. I never expected to lead such a life. In fact, I'm not leading at all. The best I can do is hang on and scramble for a good view of it all.
Yeah.
And I love that image. I often think of it as, it's like, you know, the best you can do is surf the waves. It's because you can't stop, you can't sort of try and control them. You just try and surf it as best you can. Very early on, one of the early issues, he describes having a little kid as like living in a cartoon. It was funny reading these old issues, and I kept finding letters from me, which I'd written them, and one of them was earlier than I thought. I wrote it when my own son was, my first kid was 9 months old. And I wrote to him and I said, it's lovely reading another comic by a dad. And I said to him, you know, I loved where you said it's like living in a cartoon, because that is exactly how it felt to me, you know. Suddenly life is bigger and crazier and brighter and more hilarious, but more intense in so many ways.
Yeah.
Hello. Yeah. No. You do well.
Well, that was my, well, you know, like sort of wrap-up voice. So if you
the tone of that was, well.
I'm psyched about this episode because I'm hoping, because I do, it is interesting, like, sort of how, like, overlooked it seems like his work is. So, like, I hope people will sort of go and look at some of this stuff. The last comment I wanted to make just had to do with, like, we talked about page layouts and stuff like that. One thing I do think is another great thing about this book is just how, as all over the places it is, it's very readable. Like, your eyes just continually move in the right direction. So he's good in that way, too. Just wanted to say that.
I wanted to ask, I assume both you guys have a history with Marvel comics or superhero comics more than I do. And if you don't, you can stop me now. But is that sort of the kind of propulsion that you would see in a 70s Silver Surfer comic where he's just like going through space looking for Galactus or something? I didn't read a lot of these comics. Is that the kind of energy you would see? And is Joe kind of riffing on that a lot or just building on it in some of these comics?
I didn't read them either, so Mike's going to have to answer.
Oh, shit.
I don't know either.
All right.
I don't know. Clearly Joe did. I mean, he's definitely riffing on it in places.
Yeah. I like how he riffs on pop culture. It's a way, like, yeah, it has a way like of making like Star Trek references not seem like bad. You know, he's referencing like Star Trek The Next Generation, but it all just feels like fun chaos. Anyway,
when you mentioned layout, it's one of the things I love about Joe's comics is the crazy, crazy things he does with layout. And there's this moment in the early on story from issue 7 about, or it must be issue 6, no issue, I don't know, anyway. That was issue 7. So this early on story, the last one about his divorce, where he's at the comics convention and it starts going all strange. But for most of the story, he's just drawing with regular panels, you know, with a space between the panels. And then there's this extraordinary sequence where he finds his way back to the convention table and he finds his wife is gone, everyone's vanished, there's just empty tables. All his comics have gone, except for one copy of Silly Daddy number 7, The Small But Real Divorce. And he finds it and says, but I haven't even started this one yet. Yeah. And he reads it, and it tells the story of how they finally did end the marriage. And he's reading it in the comic. But in the middle of reading this incredibly intense thing about how his marriage ends, he says, there's something different about these pages. I know, instead of boxes for panels, I used a grid for panels. It got me more drawing space. I'm going to have to try that. And then you realize that the last few pages, that's what he's been doing.
It's amazing.
And to him, all of that stuff is just as kind of alive and intense as everything else in his life. You know, wow, I can interact with pictures in a completely new way.
Yeah, that's it. Everything else is equally alive in his life, whether it's a grid, whether it's the divorce, whether it's the relationship with his family and his kid and all that. You're right. Everything is equally alive. That's the fabulous thing about this comic. I was going to go all the way back to issue 2. Issue 2 is all about him getting home and going to work on his bike nothing but. Yeah, it's intense. And it's full of, it's again, it's so propulsive. And there's all sorts of, it's mostly boxes and panels if you're going to focus on the page layouts, but there's a lot of movement inside a single panel. There's maps, there's close-ups, there are bigger panels where there's a lot of room, and there's a lot of claustrophobia when the cars are getting too close. And again, you get some good digressions back to home. It's just a great, that issue alone is great too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's another one he edited, actually, for the collection.
Is that right?
There's a lot of swearing in the original version.
Well, I've got The Long Goodbye. I'm going to have to go take a peek again at it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, the MF word is in there. Let's compare that to the new edition.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. In fact, there's this whole sequence where he talks about how he says, I swear to myself also, it's a peculiar name game. I use the word fucking as an adjective for positions I make until I come up with a name for the pose. And he's got a drawings of himself saying, fucking Hightail, fucking Spread Eagle, fucking JFK, fucking Suicide. And in the re-edition, it's like say, yo, Hightail, yo, Spread Eagle.
Yeah.
You know what's funny about
but it's not
that edit, and then also every time he's edited out John Porcellino's name, he changed the word, but he doesn't change the spacing. So like every time instead of saying John it says Ow, but it will all say Ow, and then there's a unnaturally large space for where like the H and the N would have gone, and like where the word John would have fit.
I read the dialogue as this new comic by Al.
Yes, Al in the
Al in the fan.
And the yo one is the same thing, because it's a much shorter word, so you can see like in one of the panels where there's more space.
Yeah. I have to say that the only thing that on a very very selfish way that I feel sad about with Joe's religious life now is some of those edits I felt were a bit of a shame, and also. Some of my favorite stories he's ever done are not in that collection and will probably never be brought back into print. So issue 8, I think there's 2 pages from issue 8 in that collection, but it's such an extraordinary story. It was from a flip issue he did with John Porcellino. He did about 3 of those where it was a story by John on one side and then you flip the comic over and it's a story by Joe. 2 of them were called Silly Cat. But he did a story for that called Half Baked Barroom Romance, and it was about going to this bowling alley with his friends and having a mad crush on the woman behind the bar. And it's one of the most incredibly inventive, beautiful, complex human comics I've ever seen. And for years, I've used sequences from that whenever I teach a class. Because there's things he does in that comic that are just so inventive. There's a bit where his friend John is playing table soccer for a while, and Joe goes and drags him away because he's like, I've got to get out of here. So he drags his friend away from the table soccer, and his friend's walking away, and he's still got these little kind of phantom levers in his hand as he's walking along. It's like his body is still kind of playing table soccer even as he walks away.
Uh-huh.
And this sequence is where he's talking to people and the people walk away, and you have like 5 images of the person in the same panel, or you have multiple arms where they're making gestures and things. And as he drives away, he's got like this vision of the barmaid naked kind of floating over his head about to give him this embrace. It's just full of little things like that that are so playful and beautiful and creative. But he's probably never going to reprint that because it's, kind of rude. Yeah. And the one about the valets as well is an extraordinary comic.
Yeah.
I'd love it if those things could see print again. I don't know. Maybe someone could illegally share them online. No, I didn't say that, Joe.
That's great.
I wouldn't do that.
The theft.
But I guess that's that. It's that sort of that voluntary suppression of his own work, I think, is the one sadness I have about it. Because apart from that, he's working, finding jobs for people with disabilities. He's got a bigger family now. He's got more kids, and he's. It just seems like he's doing well in life, and I'm really happy about that. But I wish more people could read those comics.
That Silly Daddy's on the back of Belmont Harbor. I'm looking at it online. There were a lot of copies of that. John had a lot of copies at one point. He might still.
Yeah, that's the one. It's yeah.
All right, guys. Well, I really enjoyed that, and I feel charged up to make comics. So I appreciate it. Thanks, guys, for coming on.
What's the line again, Dylan, about the bomb squad?
Let's all say it together.
He says, "This isn't the bomb squad, so take unnecessary chances."
Yeah, well, he wasn't around for Twitter, so he doesn't know.